Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is September 2nd, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Mill. The title of today's podcast is Apneic and the O-O-O-2-O for Rapid Sequence Intubation. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Rory Spiegel. Rory is a clinical instructor at the University of Maryland and a recent grad of Stony Brook's Resuscitation Fellowship. He writes an excellent blog called EM Nerd, which he describes as nihilistic ramblings. Welcome back to the SGEM, Rory.
Thanks, Ken. Happy to be back.
Well, this is the start of season number 6, and I am thrilled to have another nerd like you to help me launch the season.
Thanks, Ken. You know, I'm quite happy to have made it to season 6. It's a bit like making it to season 6 on Game of Thrones. You know, you've got past all the early slaughter, and you hope your character has a bit more durability going forward.
Oh, thanks for the contemporary reference. Well, any new updates on your life before I tell the S-Jammers a little bit more about season 6?
Yeah, well, I found life as an attending a bit too easy, so I decided to go back for a second fellowship. So I'm currently a critical care fellow at the University of Maryland in Baltimore.
So you just really like being a student, don't you?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, let's see if we can launch season 6. You mentioned Game of Thrones. I'm going to dial it back to maybe a bit more of my era. So here we go. Evidence-based medicine, the final frontier. These are the episodes of The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Its ongoing mission to critically appraise recent publications, to seek out great guest skeptics, and cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year, using the power of social media, so patients get the best care based on the best evidence.
God damn it, man. I'm a doctor, not a skeptic.
Well, I actually think you are pretty much a skeptic, or a nerd, or even a nihilist, or maybe it's all three. But seriously, we have a lot of excellent episodes lined up with some of your favorite guest skeptics returning. You can also expect more SGEM hot off the press from AEM, and we are actually going to try a Facebook Live special event in October. Stay tuned for details.
I can't wait.
All right, Rory. Give us a case.
All right. So you have a 68-year-old female who presents to the emergency department with shortness of breath. She has experienced fevers, chills, and a productive cough worsening over the past 5 days. Her chest x-ray demonstrates bilateral infiltrates consistent with multifocal pneumonia. Over her emergency department course, the patient starts to decompensate, and despite high-flow nasal cannula and broad-spectrum antibiotics, the decision is made to intubate the patient. The question arises whether apneic oxygenation should be used during the rapid sequence intubation.
Well, much has been written about the benefits of apneic oxygenation. Its physiological underpinnings are sound, and its logistical and resource-based costs are minimal.
And because of this, it has enjoyed widespread adoption throughout the emergency medicine and critical care world. Despite its popularity, the evidence supporting its use has been less than inspirational.
There have been some studies in various clinical settings, like the operating room, critical care setting, and pre-hospital, that have demonstrated benefits of apneic oxygenation. There are two observational studies from the ED showing an association between apneic oxygenation and an increased first-pass success rate without hypoxemia and a reduction in the incidence of hypoxemia during the rapid sequence intubation of patients with intracranial hemorrhage.
The facilitating endotracheal intubation biolaryngoscopy technique and apneic oxygenation within the intensive care unit, or the FELLOW trial, was a randomized control trial demonstrating no difference in desaturation rates with apneic oxygenation versus usual care.
However, Rory, this study was performed in the intensive care unit, not in the emergency department setting. So let's get to that clinical question.
Yeah, so the clinical question, does the use of apneic oxygenation in the emergency department during rapid sequence intubation decrease the rate of clinically important desaturation, leading to a decrease in peri-intubation complications and death?
All right, what do you got for a reference?
So the reference here is Caputo et al., Emergency Department Use of Apneic Oxygenation versus Usual Care During Rapid Sequence Intubation, a Randomized Control Trial, or the ENDIO trial. And this was published in Academic Emergency Medicine in 2017.
And you actually know the lead author.
Yeah, somewhat. I spoke to him after his trial, after publishing this trial, and I wrote a blog piece on this, and he was kind enough to make some comments, and we kind of discussed the methodology and the results.
Oh, excellent. Let's run through the PICO, though. What was the population?
So these were emergency department patients greater than 18 years old requiring rapid sequence intubation.
And they had some exclusions, patients in cardiac or traumatic arrest, or if pre-oxygenation was not performed. How about the intervention? What was the specific intervention they were using?
The apneic oxygenation group received standard pre-oxygenation plus 15 liters per minute of flow using a standard nasal cannula as well as an end-tidal nasal cannula set at 15 liters per minute, both of which were started during the pre-oxygenation phase and continued through the apneic phase.
And so what did they compare it to, Rory?
So the comparison group or the control group used no apneic oxygenation, but again, received standard pre-oxygenation. And in this case, that was either flush rate O2 via a non-rebreather, a BVM with a PEEP valve, or a BiPAP circuit with an FiO2 of 100%.
All right, so let's go through their outcomes. They had primary outcomes and they had secondary outcomes. What was the primary outcome they were looking for?
The primary outcome was the mean lowest oxygen saturation between the two groups.
And how about their secondary outcomes?
They looked at the rate of first pass success, desaturation below 90%, desaturation below 80%, and the average time to desaturation between the two groups.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, there was no difference in the lowest mean oxygen saturation between the two groups. The application of apneic oxygenation during rapid sequence intubation did not prevent desaturation of patients in this study population, end of quote. All right, let's run through the 11 questions in the checklist for randomized clinical trials. The first one is the study populations. Were these ED patients?
Yes.
Did they adequately randomize them?
Yes.
Did they conceal that randomization?
Yes.
Now, did they analyze the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes, they did.
Was it consecutive recruitment?
Yep.
The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, it appeared so.
Now, how about blinding? Were all the participants, that means the patients, the clinicians, and even the outcome assessors, were they unaware of group allocation?
No.
All right, question 8. All groups were treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes.
And did they have complete follow-up?
Yep.
What about patient-important outcomes? Were all of them considered?
This one I'm a little unsure of.
All right, and the last question. The treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
Well, let's run through the key results then. They screened 262 patients and included a total of 200. The mean age was in the mid-50s, with the most common indication for intubation being pulmonary issues. Rory, what was the primary outcome?
The authors found no difference between the mean lowest oxygen saturation between the two groups, and that was 92% versus 93%, with a p-value of 0.08.
All right, now they did mention a number of secondary outcomes, and I'm going to mention a couple here. So they looked at desaturation, whether it was less than 90 or less than 80%, no difference between the two groups. And then the other issue was when they looked at mortality, total mortality and mortality within 24 hours, and again, no difference between the two groups. But then, Rory, both you and I had trouble looking for that first pass success rate and also the average time to desaturation between the two groups. It was in the methodology, I believe. It was in, you know, their list of what their secondary outcomes were, but I couldn't find them in the results section.
Yeah, nor could I. I actually spoke to Nick about this when we talked, and he had mentioned just that they were so similar, they didn't think there was a need to put them in the results. But essentially, first pass success was 89% in the overall and didn't really differ much between the two groups.
All right. Well, thanks for reaching out to him. But let's talk a little nerdy. I mean, overall, this was a very well-done trial, and the authors went to great lengths to ensure proper randomization and that proper pre-oxygenation techniques were utilized in both of the groups. However, we're going to go through how many? Five things that threaten the validity of the results.
Yeah, so the authors utilized the lowest mean oxygen saturation during the peri-intubation period as their primary outcome. They powered their study to find a 5-point difference in oxygen saturation between the treatment and control groups. And this leads to a problem with both statistical and clinical validity.
Okay, you are the EM nerd. So why don't you take us through the problem of statistical validity?
All right, I'd be happy to. So, statistical validity. In this case, the lowest arterial oxygen saturation during intubation is a continuous variable, in contrast to a discrete variable such as the rate of clinically significant desaturation or a dichotomous cutoff of less than 80%. And the major advantage of using a continuous parametric variable is the statistical power it provides, allowing researchers to demonstrate statistically significant results with small sample sizes.
Well, typically we use a standard t-test to analyze continuous variables. This is basically a comparison of the two group mean values. In order for such testing to be valid, a number of assumptions must be met. The data surrounding the sample mean must fall in a symmetrical distribution. It is not uncommon, especially in cohorts with an undersized sample size, that the resultant sample will not exhibit a normal distribution.
Yeah, and this is especially true when looking at variables like oxygen saturation, where the majority of the results will cluster around one tail. In cases where the resulting data is asymmetrically distributed, a comparison of means may fail to accurately describe the differences between the two groups. You can imagine two populations where the means are fairly similar, but the groups surrounding them are very, very different.
In such instances, non-parametric testing is required. Now, non-parametric testing eliminates the need for symmetrical distribution by listing each data point in rank order. As such, the quantitative difference between the measurements becomes inconsequential. This allows for the performance of statistical analysis without the assumption of normal distribution.
Despite the advantages of these types of statistical manipulations, the ability to quantify the specific magnitude of each data point is lost. Rather, non-parametric testing is only capable of locating the position of each data point as it relates to the remainder of the cohort. With this loss of granularity comes a significant reduction in statistical power. And so when you power your study to assess lowest mean oxygen saturation, assuming a normal distribution, and then perform an analysis using a non-parametric testing, you have statistically limited your ability to find a difference.
Wow, that was pretty nerdy. Nicely done. Okay, so let's go through the second point. And this is talking about clinical validity. Is the lowest oxygen saturation observed during intubation truly a clinically important measurement?
Yeah, and this is probably a much more important point. This endpoint inherently places value on higher oxygen saturation levels, making the assumption that an oxygen saturation of 52% is clinically preferable to an oxygen saturation of 35%. And we know the accuracy of waveform pulse oximetry suffers once the oxygen saturation drops below 90%.
In these cases, the value of the patient's true O2 level can vary widely from what is recorded on the monitor. As such, it's hard to place a hierarchical value to the pulse oximetry level less than 90%.
Yeah, so to say an oxygen saturation of 53% holds a greater clinical value than an oxygen saturation of 35% is just inaccurate. Then, to further distill this data points into a rank order renders this data almost unusable.
A more clinically meaningful endpoint would be the rate of oxygen desaturation below a specific threshold that it's associated with an increased likelihood of negative sequelae. Take, for an example, the incidence of oxygen saturation less than 80% or 90%. In this case, a continuous scale, oxygen saturation, is converted into a discrete dichotomous outcome. The entirety of the data can now only fall above or below a specific cutoff.
And while likely now we have a more clinically meaningful endpoint, this divide leads to a loss of granularity. As such, an oxygen saturation of 75% becomes no different than one of 32%, as both fall below the 80% threshold. The conversion of a continuous variable to a discrete data comes at the cost of statistical power. And so once again, because the study was powered to demonstrate a difference in a continuous outcome, it is now incapable of detecting a difference in dichotomous variables of importance. So we have an inherently underpowered study.
Well, Rory, I hope we didn't lose everybody with that really intensely nerdy stuff. So let's get into some really patient-oriented things. And this is point number three, patient-oriented outcomes. I do not think a patient really cares about what their O2 sat was while they were being intubated. In fact, I can never remember a patient saying, hey, Ken, or Dr. Milne, what was the number of my O2 sat while you were intubating me? I mean, this is a disease-oriented outcome.
Right. And, you know, we use these outcomes because we assume they will lead to a benefit in patient care, but we're not quite sure. Mortality is a much more important outcome and very easy to measure and define. In this study, the mortality was no different at 24 hours, or the overall mortality was also no different.
However, we do not know about the neurologic function of the survivors, and this would be the most patient-oriented outcome. How many patients survived neurologically intact?
Right.
All right, so why don't you get on to the fourth point, and that is external validity.
Right. So essentially, how do these results apply to the population that you're treating? And this study was conducted in a single urban center teaching hospital. They had a highly effective protocol for pre-oxygenation and demonstrated a high level of competency in the skills of intubation. Most of their patients were intubated in less than 60 seconds. As such, there was minimal opportunity for patients to experience clinically important desaturation. In fact, only 16% of the population desaturated below 90%, and only 3% desaturated below 80%.
And greater than 80% of patients were pre-oxygenated with a bag valve mask. And there was about a 50-50 split between those that had direct versus those who had video laryngoscopy. More than 95% of the patients were intubated by residents and less than 5% by attendings. So how will this apply to your community or to your rural hospital, with the intubations being done by, I don't know, a respiratory therapist, a non-board certified emergency physician, or a physician assistant?
Yeah, and we have reasonable evidence that apneic oxygenation works on a physiological level. So are we not seeing a benefit in this study because it doesn't work, or because we tested it in a whole bunch of patients that were going to do just fine no matter what we did?
And this is where we each have to decide whether the evidence is for or against apneic oxygenation is strong enough to incorporate it into our rapid sequence intubation strategy. And of course, we need to balance this with the cost of a nasal cannula and its logistical complexity its use adds to your rapid sequence intubation. But let's get to the fifth and final point, and this is the burden of proof. The scientific method puts the burden of proof on those making the positive claim. In this situation, the positive claim would be that apneic oxygenation provides a patient-oriented benefit in an undifferentiated emergency department patient requiring rapid sequence intubation. This study does not provide evidence to reject that null hypothesis.
No, but the absence of evidence is not the same as the absence of benefit. In this case, to find a difference when so few events happened, a far more statistically robust study is required.
Okay, that's enough nerdy talk. Let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So the author's conclusions are quite reasonable. The use of apneic oxygenation is likely to add little to the majority of rapid sequence intubations in an unselected emergency department population.
All right, how about giving us an SGEM bottom line?
Apneic oxygenation may still have a role during rapid sequence intubation of emergency department patients, but it likely adds little when proper pre-oxygenation strategies are used.
So Rory, how are you going to take this information and apply it clinically?
So Ken, if we were guaranteed successful endotracheal intubation with minimal delay in all our patients, then the majority of our preparation for RSI would be rendered superfluous. However, we have an undifferentiated cohort presenting to the emergency department. As with much of our preparation, apneic oxygenation is employed universally in the event of a rare case of unexpected difficulty. And while its utility in these patients is still unknown, an underpowered trial in which so few patients experience the outcome in question does not disprove its potential benefit. So from my perspective, I'm still using it, given that its logistical cost is small and its potential benefit in a few patients might be high.
Now, this is interesting because, you know, for the final point, we always have a case resolution. And for the case resolution, evidence-based medicine says you look at the literature and the literature informs your care. It directs your care, but it doesn't dictate your care. And different people can interpret the literature differently and apply it to their patient population differently. You work in a big, large urban center, and I work in a smaller community setting. So we're going to have two case resolutions. You get to give the first case resolution.
All right. So the patient was pre-oxygenated using a nasal cannula underneath a BiPAP circuit, and the cannula was set at 15 liters per minute during the apneic period. The patient was intubated on first pass success without hypoxia and was resuscitated and transferred to the ICU.
All right, and my case resolution is the patient was pre-oxygenated using a bag valve mask and was successfully intubated on first pass without hypoxia and was resuscitated and transferred to the intensive care unit. All right, now, so what are we going to tell the patient's family? Well, I would say something like, your mother has severe pneumonia and has already gotten antibiotics. She also needed extra oxygen to help with her breathing. Despite all this treatment, her oxygen levels were falling, and we needed to put a tube down her throat to deliver more oxygen. Everything went well, and she's doing better now. We will transfer your mother to the intensive care unit to continue her treatment. All right. Hey, it's time for the first Keener contest question of season number 6. So what's the question, Rory?
So the question is, who is credited with discovering oxygen in 1774?
Oh, and I'm going to give him a little hint. It was not Jason Priestley from 90210. If you think you know the answer, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, there is some other FOMED material available on apneic oxygenation, and I will put some links in the show notes. Thanks, Rory, for starting season number 6 of the SGEM in a true skeptical nerdy fashion.
Thanks, Ken. I have been a fan since as far back as season 1, so it is truly an honor to start off season 6.
Rory, you're too kind. But could you give us the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you've heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.